You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Brina Clark's first novel, River Cross My Heart, was an Oprah's Book Club selection and became an international bestseller. Now her second novel, Stand the Storm, has just been published by Little Brown. I'm pleased that it has brought her to my show today. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
Both of your novels are set in the Georgetown neighborhood of Washington, D.C., although in different historical eras. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write about this area? Is it a place that you lived in?
Actually, I didn't grow up in the Georgetown neighborhood, but I did grow up in Washington, D.C. My folks grew up in Georgetown in the teens and 20s, and on through that period, they left officially in the 1950s. They clung pretty tenaciously to their recollections of the neighborhood, and I always wondered why.
And because so it's become a gentrified research. White neighborhood. That's the way I've always known it. So it was once an African-American neighborhood?
Well, it was never totally an African-American neighborhood. I would characterize it as having been a diverse neighborhood until the 1950s. There were always people of both races who lived in Georgetown.
Which surprises me because Washington, D.C. was a kind of a segregated city. Mm-hmm. Until fairly late in our history. It was always a southern town, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely a southern town. I think one of the things that characterized Georgetown was that very, very rich people have always lived there. Wealthy people have lived there and have maintained homes. And many of the African Americans who lived there did domestic service work and lived nearby. And that sort of evolved over the years.
And that fits in with this story. Stand the Storm is set during the Civil War era, yes. And it tells the story of the Coates family who originally came to Georgetown as slaves. Mm-hmm. Was there any inspiration for these characters, somebody you have heard about or known about?
Not directly. I got inspired by it because I was speaking with a friend who's a local archivist and historian. And we were talking about the emancipation, the compensated emancipation scheme or plan that Abraham Lincoln instituted in the District of Columbia, which gave Washington a bit of a different situation vis-a-vis the slaves who lived there.
Slaves weren't just freed. There was slave owners were paid a certain amount of
right.
money.
This occurred in early in April of 1862. So it happened about 6 to 8 months before the General Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. It was an idea that Lincoln had because there was a lot of criticism about slave owning in the capital of the Union. There had always been people who had criticized slave owning in the District of Columbia. One idea that Lincoln had was that maybe some of the slave owners would calm down and leave the conflict if they thought they could get financial compensation.
But in your story, there's a complicated situation because some slaves had bought their own freedom.
Yes.
And so compensation really wasn't appropriate, and yet the former owner said, hey, I want my money too.
Oh, yes, because whenever you have a situation where money can be paid and people apply for compensation, you're going to have some people who are going to try to take advantage of that system.
So there were double dippers.
Oh, absolutely.
Washington's always had double dippers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When the novel begins, Sewing Annie Coates, the matriarch, is a slave in the Ridley Plantation in Maryland. Mm-hmm. How did she get that name, Sewing Annie?
Well, she's identified primarily by the work that she does. She, as a young girl, is separated from her own mother, her own biological mother, and she's put in with another slave, with a slave woman whose name is Knitting Annie, who does all of the knitting, quilting, weaving, fabric dyeing, all of that sort of work related to textiles.
And a lot of women named Annie. There's Field Annie.
Yes.
There's Yeah. Cook and Annie.
Yes.
A way of dehumanizing these women?
Well, sure, sure. Many slaves received a name that the slave owner identified them by, and that was one of the things that I was working with there, that the slave owners had an idea of who these people were, and the people themselves would have a different idea.
So the slave owner would say, oh, Sewing Annie, okay, that's right, the woman who does the sewing here.
Right. A way of not giving them a specific identity.
And Sewing Annie is not only an accomplished seamstress, but she's also a knitter, and she teaches her son, Gabriel, those skills.
Yes.
So he's rented out to a tailor in Georgetown because he has those skills. Was that common practice among slave owners, hiring out their slaves
with specialized skills? Yes, indeed. Hiring
so he didn't
out
have to
was
sell
a common practice.
He didn't have to sell it. It's like a rental property.
Oh, yes, of course. A great many slaves were hired out by the people who owned them for all kinds of reasons. You may have a number of slaves doing agricultural work on your plantation, your farm, and in one year you may have less need of people planting one crop or another. You may be going to another crop that uses individuals differently. And you may also have a neighbor, as in this case also in my novel, you may have a neighbor who has a need for additional agricultural laborers so that you can hire some of your people to them and maximize their earning potential. Often people who received slaves as part of their inheritance would use the slaves. They would hire them out and be able to live on the income that the slaves produce.
Without having to run their own plantation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You include a lot of period detail about Georgetown in the pre-Civil War era. You know an awful lot about running the tailoring business at that time. How did you get all of that information? I know writers do research,
yes.
But is there a lot of information available about this time?
Actually, I was surprised at the amount of information that is available, but it's not on the surface. You've got to dig down and do quite a bit of spade work. A lot of people have written about the mid-19th century. There's tons of books. I got a lot of information there. I also visited historic houses. Especially, I always like to do a commercial for the Frederick Douglass House in Anacostia in Washington. I visited there and a number of other historic houses as well.
My guest is Breena Clark, whose latest book is Stand the Storm. It is published by Little Brown. The tailor, Abraham Pearl, sells his shop to Jonathan Ridley, the son of the slave owner, mm-hmm. and then goes west, and Gabriel takes over running the business. So he's really the tailor, but he's still just a slave.
Yes, yes.
And people come into the shop, and they just dealt with him as though he was the tailor?
Yes, they do. And there are a few details that are taken care of in the novel that would explain that for the reader. But yes, there are great... There's a wide variety of jobs that were performed by slaves. And I think that's really one of the misconceptions that we have about slavery. The idea is that it was all agricultural work done on large plantations. In fact, slavery jobs were performed by slaves at almost every economic level.
Well, how did Gabriel get enough money to buy his own freedom? And then... his mother's, his sister Ellen's, mm-hmm. and also a runaway slave named Mary.
Yes. Well, he produces textiles that he's able to sell, and he's able to keep that money. I don't want to give away too much, but
yeah, well,
he begins that at an early stage, and he saves, and they accumulate.
Well, Edward P. Jones surprised a lot of people with his great novel, The Known World, which was about a black slave owner.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't realize that African Americans also owned slaves. If they were freed, they could own slaves too.
Well, yes, you could own slaves under several circumstances that might include African Americans. Certainly, if you had a particular type of farm or agricultural enterprise, it might behoove you to have slaves to work it. The thing that has to be remembered is that slavery is, it was an economic system, and it certainly was a linchpin of our early economic system. So you have slavery in a lot of places other than just in agricultural. Also, there were individuals who were legally the owners of slaves who may have been family members, a wife, a son or daughter, a mother, or other family members. Oftentimes, a person might purchase the freedom of another individual simply to help that person.
Yeah, there's a lot of history here, and not always the kind of history that we learned in high school.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably important for you, like writing about the Underground Railroad in a way that really gives a sense of just how dangerous it was.
Well, yes. I wanted to dig deeper and also present a wider panorama of Washington in that period. I wanted Stand the Storm to be about individuals who are enslaved and become free.
But you also tell the kind of a story that I'd never thought about before. Mm-hmm. One of your subplots involves Ellen, who, while working on a neighboring plantation, has been given a baby born to a white cook's assistant. The baby's father was a black slave. And the mother would have been in danger, I guess, if she had kept the baby, because it would have revealed that she'd had a relationship with a black man.
Sure, absolutely. And you wouldn't have wanted that was a dangerous thing to acknowledge.
It was okay for white slave owners to produce children with their black slaves, but the other way around wasn't so acceptable.
Absolutely not. Keep in mind that slave children followed the condition of their mother. If you allowed free white women to bear the children of slaves, you'd have a hard time controlling that circumstance. You'd have individuals who, with mixed backgrounds, who had a parent who was a slave, who may inherit goods and real property, something that you didn't want to do. Women's behavior in the 19th century was pretty strictly controlled. I was surprised, though, to learn that white women who bore mixed-race children, the children of slaves, the children of black men, were often jailed, certainly could be hung or otherwise, treated violently, could lose all of their rights as citizens. So it was a dangerous circumstance.
And you also deal with the whole issue of racial identity here, because the child can pass for white and has to make that decision of how to live her life.
I think one of the things that I'd like to have people to understand is that we have a much wider racial identity in our country. That the typical American, in many people's minds, is a white American. But in fact, we have always had what I would consider a significant population that is a mixed-race population. Certainly, Barack Obama is not the first mixed-race person we can encounter.
And not just always black and white. Sometimes there's also Native American in the mix.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And Asian.
Yes, yes. And I think also white ethnic mixtures are meaningful as well. There are people whose background is Irish-American with a mixture of black. Certainly Indian tribes, Native American tribes, mixed with African people of African background. So we have got a lot of mixture. And we've had public policy to control the access that people have vis-a-vis their race, so that we look at a person's face and decide, based on the color of the skin, where that person's strata is.
Your debut novel, River Crossed My Heart, was an international bestseller, helped quite a bit by, as she has helped so many good writers, Oprah's book club. It's been 9 years since that book came out. What's taken you so long? Have you been working on this book all that time?
I have been working on this book about 5 years. Part of the other time, I was working on another novel that has not been published. So.
And what's next? Another book about Georgetown?
Not about Georgetown. I'm working on another novel that, too, is set in the 19th century. And it also deals with enslaved people, but it is not set in Georgetown specifically.
This book is Stand the Storm, and it is published by Little Brown. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, Breena Clark.
Thank you very much for having me.